the organizers, and all the participants, everybody here. It's been a very successful conference. I've really enjoyed myself this week. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. So for this talk, this is one of the informal talks that are scheduled this week. And what I'm going to do is try to take an informal approach to describe what I study, the moduli space of curves. And I study the moduli space of curves, well, I do it through fat graphs. So when you say moduli space, you say even fat graphs. Lots of people have lots of different ideas of what that means. And I think it'll be clear, probably what I talk about everybody has seen or can agree on. So to start off with, I'm going to talk about the moduli space of curves. So I should start with the definition. We want to get a feel for what the space is. And I'm not going to define it as a stack or a functor. This is an informal seminar. So let's just start by defining it as a set. So as a set, it's a collection of isomorphism classes of compact Riemann surfaces of genus. So let's call it C of genus G. And a compact Riemann surface is equivalent to an algebraic curve, so it's called the moduli space of curves, even though I'm talking about surfaces. So I've defined it as a set, but I really want to talk about the topology on it. And I think the easiest way to get a feel for the topology is to realize the moduli space as a quotient of the Teichmuller space. So we know that the moduli space, genus G, is a quotient of the Teichmuller space by the action of the modular group, genus G. And the modular group acts on this space. The Teichmuller space is a contractible space, homeomorphic to Rn. The action is properly discontinuous. So this gives us the nice property that it's an orbifold. And I'm going to use this property when I guess, probe the structure of the moduli space. Part of the importance of the moduli space lies in the fact that there's a family of surfaces that lies above it called the universal curve. And by other name, it's called MG, 1. So what this is as a set is the collection of pairs, C and X, where C is a curve in a moduli space, and X, or C is, X is a point in C. And once again, this is going to be an orbifold. We have an analogous construction of a Teichmuller space, mod the action of a mapping class group. So it's also going to have the structure of an orbifold. And the structure of an orbifold is like a quotient space, but it's a little bit more. It's sort of a decorated quotient space. And I guess the decoration comes in where we have the singular points of the orbifold structure. And those singular points are going to correspond to where this action is not quite free, and it's going to translate into curves or surfaces with non-trivial automorphisms. More generally, you often talk about the moduli space of curves with n-marked points, and that's similarly defined as collections of C and X1 through Xn, and usually you have it so that these points are distinct, and that's the case that I'm going to have here. Once again, this is an orbifold. The algebraic methods in studying this really lead to, well, the nicest thing, as far as I'm concerned, of the algebraic methods, well, they're really powerful, but the thing that I use is that this space has a compactification, the Delane-Mumford compactification, and it's denoted MGN bar. And this is actually itself a moduli space, and it's the moduli space of stable curves. And I think some of the previous talks have mentioned about this and the stability condition and things like that. And in order for this definition to really make sense, you usually have the requirement that 2g minus 2 plus n is greater than 0, which just kind of cleans up a couple small cases of genus 0 and genus 1 stable curve. The nice thing about this compactification is, well, it's a moduli space itself, but it's also an orbifold. it's a compact orbifold. And because it's a compact orbifold, you can use a lot of the tools that you're used to using for compact manifolds. And for me and for this talk, what that's going to include is it's going to include a form of Durham cohomology, and it's also going to include a form of Poincaré duality. So since we have the Poincaré duality, the cohomology will have an intersection theory. And the intersection theory, I think, in the algebraic setting, kind of comes along for the ride, but I'm actually going to use it in the topological setting. And what my talk is really going to do is explicitly roll up my sleeves, get my hands dirty, and look at what one of these intersections looks like. So maybe I've fooled you into thinking that you actually know what the topology of the moduli space is, because I defined it. But I really didn't define the Teich-Mueller space. And if I were to define the Teich-Mueller space, I'd define it in terms of the moduli space. So it's a little chicken and egg thing. So that really wouldn't work either. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start talking about fat graphs. And hopefully through fat graphs, we'll get a feel for what the topology of the moduli space is. So we've had a couple talks already about fat graphs. So what is a fat graph? It's a graph, connected graph, with a cyclic order given at each vertex. And generally, I'm going to require that the valence of each vertex is greater than or equal to 3. It's at least trivalent. I'm going to loosen that a little bit later, but for the most part, whenever I refer to a fat graph, it'll be valence greater than or equal to 3. So what are some examples? We know that, I think these are some examples that we've already seen. This is an ordinary graph. And by giving a cyclic order to each vertex, I can actually get two different fat graphs out of this graph. And this one, if we thicken it, we know that we can embed this in a surface. And we get a fat graph that looks like this. And this can be embedded in a sphere. And so we can associate to this graph a genus, genus equals 0, and a number of marked points, which is the number of boundary components, or components of the complement of this graph in the surface. So n would be equal to 3 in this case. In this case, if I fatten the graph, the picture is a little bit different. I can fatten each vertex separately, but now the orientations on the two sides are reversed. So in order to glue them to keep the orientation consistent, I have to put a twist in there. A little bit funny. So in order to draw it so that I use the orientation of the board, I would have to draw it a little bit differently. I would have to draw it as such. And to view this embedded in a Riemann surface, this is just what we're used to if we try to build the torus out of a hexagon. So we get the curve looking like that. And so we find out that the genus is equal to 1. And, well, there's one hexagon that we use to build it, so n is equal to 1 in this case. The next thing I want to talk about is the automorphisms of a fat graph. So, first of all, what's an isomorphism? It's a bijection of, now it's a little bit tricky, I have to say a bijection of half edges, so you have to imagine sort of cutting each of these edges in half. So it's a bijection of half edges and vertices that preserves the following things. First of all, we want to preserve the sense of edges. If I split an edge in half, I don't want them to go to two different edges when I move it. I want to preserve, of course, the incidence of the edges to the vertices, the cyclic order. And in this case, I also want to preserve the boundary components. So let's see what that looks like by example. Here, I have a graph that has 3 boundary components. And any automorphism I make of this graph has to preserve these boundary components. And what you find is that, well, we have nowhere to move to. Anytime I move an edge, it'll move one of the boundary components around. So here we have the order of the automorphism.
labeled, I preserve the labeling.
Right. Yeah, I haven't really defined the labeling of the fat graph yet. So, yeah, preserving the boundaries. Yeah. And in this case, with this graph, I have two vertices of valence 3, and you can see that if you rotate both of them, that the cyclic order is preserved, so we actually have an automorphism of order 3. But I also have a symmetry where I flip the two vertices, sort of a mirror symmetry of the graph. And that, you can see why we have this sort of strange part of the definition where we talk about half edges. Because when I flip the graph, I'm really swapping half edges, but I'm preserving the edges. So what you find is that the order of the automorphism group here is equal to 6. So I think now I'm almost ready to talk about the category. So of course we have, yeah, I talked about automorphisms. There's another type of morphism, and that's the edge collapse. So what I'm going to take is I'm going to take a non-loop edge, E, and this will live in some graph of some kind, and I can just think about collapsing this edge. I have a cyclic order assigned to each vertex, and when I collapse the edge, there's a unique way to put an orientation to the new vertex that I get. So I can talk about the edge collapse of a graph. And if I collapse, let's say, this edge of this graph, what I get is a graph that looks something like this, which is what you would get by building the torus out of a square. I wasn't sure if I wanted to comment on what happens if you collapse if you actually collapse loop edges. You can do that too. But now I'm starting to stray away from what we all agree on are fat graphs and start to sort of decorate fat graphs in different ways. So you can, for example, collapse a loop that contains an entire boundary component. But what happens is then you're left with a vertex that must represent that boundary component that has disappeared. And what happens if I have a loop that doesn't contain an entire boundary component? If I collapse that loop, really what that does is it leads to the notion of Strabel's stable graph, or Kontsevich's stable graphs. So it corresponds to pinchings and will correspond to points in the compact on the boundary of the compactification. So I just mention this here because it'll come up a little bit later. But mostly when I mean edge collapse, I'm talking about an internal edge. So now I can talk about the category. I have objects and I have morphisms, so I can define the category fat. Where the objects are isomorphism classes of labeled, I guess, fat graphs with labeled boundaries, and the morphisms are compositions of automorphisms and edge collapses. And I'm going to want them to be connected and generally at least trivalent as well. So we've seen here that if I give you a fat graph, we can get topological information out of that graph. And really what I want is I want to get geometric information out of it. I want to talk about the moduli space of curves, curves that have conformal structure or complex structure or a metric of some kind. So what the natural thing to do is to add the notion of length. So I'm going to want to talk about the length of the edges of these fat graphs. So what I'm going to want to do is actually build a space which represents fat graphs with a length attached to each edge. So what I'm going to do is for each, I guess let me just comment here, the way that I'm going to construct the space is going to be a little bit different than the way it's been discussed so far. I'm not going to talk about the geometric realization of this category or graph cohomology or things like that. If you do that, you get something that's homotopy equivalent to what you or what I want. But in this case, I'm going to get something that's actually homeomorphic to what I want. Yeah, I guess for efficiency of definition, I guess we can talk. Well, I really want isomorphism classes.
What was the question? I couldn't hear it.
Does everybody understand what I mean? I have one object for every... You don't object to the objects being isomorphism classes, right?
You said everything you said is fine.
Okay.
What is the question? I
mean,
I can't
hear. Huh? You can't use
You're confused by what is an automorphism between isomorphism classes? Or between the same?
So just rigidify slightly and just add extra data to the boundary and then just take the category with all these isomorphisms and you realize you've been right on the boundary. That's what you did.
Are we all comfortable in doing that? As the guy at the... Thinking at the board is something that, well, sometimes I'm better at than other times. And things is sort of loopy for my brain as this. I'd like to get on. Right, so for each graph, or for each element of fat graph, so each isomorphism class of graph, what I'm going to do is associate a simplex to this graph. And the simplex is going to have barycentric coordinates indexed by the edges of this graph. So in this case, I would have three edges. I'll have three barycentric coordinates of this graph. There's a little bit of ambiguity here on how I assign the edges to the coordinates, but it'll all come out in the wash. We'll find that the automorphism group of the graph will act on this simplex. And what I'll do is I'll take the quotient of the simplex by the automorphism group. And this will give me an orbifold, which I call the orbis simplex, associated to that graph. And that will resolve some of the ambiguity in choosing the coordinates. faces of the simplex, and I want to put some faces of this simplex here will correspond to simplices, orbis simplices of edge collapses of gamma. And specifically, what I want to do with this is I want to use this as some gluing data to build my space. So if I have two graphs, gamma 1 and gamma 2, which might not necessarily be distinct, and I can do edge collapses of both of them to get a new graph gamma, then what I want to do is be able to glue together the simplices corresponding to gamma 1, gamma 2, along the face corresponding to gamma. And of course, there's a little bit of ambiguity here, but when I do this, once I act on it by the automorphism group of the graph, this ambiguity will be resolved, and I'll actually be able to define a topology that I desire, and this will lead to my definition. So definition is the combinatorial moduli space will be the disjoint union over all graphs of type GN in FAT, and I'll take the open simplex corresponding to that graph and quotient out by the automorphism group. Is that all right with everybody? Because that's just check that that's well defined. It takes a moment. So the question is, well, what's the topology on it? The topology is given by this gluing construction that I talked about where I put two faces together. And the question then arises, well, what structure does this have? And I claim that this is actually an orbifold. Now, to check that it's an orbifold, you have to say around every point there's a neighborhood that's locally Rn mod the action of a finite group. And for the maximal dimensional cells, which correspond to trivalent graphs, this is obvious by the definition. And the question then says, well, we really should check this where we glue things together along the faces. And so really what I'm going to do is just sort of refer to example here. It really comes down to the properties of the associahedron that was talked about earlier. So in a codimension one face, that's where we have one collapse. And let me use a board over here. So a codimension one face is where I have a vertex of valence 4. And there's two ways to expand this. And if I put a positive length to either of these edges, what I'll get is a half ray, and they'll get glued together at the single point corresponding to the vertex of valence 4. And then if I have symmetries of the graph, it'll act on this R1 and give me an orbifold structure at this point. Of course, the structure of the rest of the graph that I have to take into consideration, but this is the sort of the basic.
To clarify that for your construction, you don't use the word category in this construction.
No.
You just use these objects, so just erase the word. You're just using this set of objects.
God.
Right. It's a pseudo
category. Oh, is that even here?
You're not using the category.
Right. Thank you.
Now everything's fine.
Thank you. I like that. So now I want to give two more examples in this case as well, because I'm actually going to use them a little bit. The next example is when I have a vertex of valence 5. So this would be a codimension 2 face. Well, some codimension 2 faces could correspond to two cases like this, and it's kind of taken care of. In this case, well, we have the associahedron, maybe A5. Maybe it's referred to. And here, there's going to be five different ways that I could pull this apart to create one new edge. And there's also going to be five ways to pull it apart so that I could create two new edges. And this corresponds to the different ways I could either draw a line across a regular pentagon and the ways to triangulate the pentagon. And if I glue these together, these cells that I would get in this case, if I add one edge, that'd be a one-dimensional cell. If I add two edges, it's a two-dimensional cell. Really, what I get is a space that looks, well, let me just use this. It looks like this, and it glues together to give me R2. So this vertex here, or the zero cell, corresponds to the five-element vertex I started with. These lines are where I expand one edge, and these would correspond to sort of trivalent trees with five leaves. And they all glue together to give me something R2, and the symmetries of the graph will act on this, and I'll get an orbifold structure, at least locally, here. The last example I'm not going to be able to draw it, but the case of a six-valent vertex. If I have a six-valent vertex, I have the same thing. I'm going to have one zero cell. It's a little bit different because it's not as symmetric as the previous cases. And note here that if I make a cut or if I take a path along one of these edges, this is when I cross this line, it's just going across a whitehead move. So I'm going to expect to have things that look like this in this case as well. So here I'll have one zero cell corresponding to this. If I expand out so that I get one edge, there's nine ways to do that. So there's going to be nine one cells. There's six ways I could pick apart two edges, and then there's three ways I can cut it in half. Everybody get that? Because you'll be quizzed on this later. 21, I think, two cells, and then there's going to be 14 three cells. And let me just tell you what the 14 three cells correspond to. Well, what are the maximal expanded graphs going to look like? Well, I'm going to have two of them that look like this, and then I'm going to get six of them that look like that, and then the last graph I have looks like this, and there's six of those. And you notice the one that I have two of has a symmetry of order 3, so they all kind of have a 6 in there. Sort of an example of orbifold tending. I'll come back. I'll use that later. So this is an orbifold. So the question remains, well, I have graphs with metric on them, an orbifold structure. Sounds very reminiscent of the moduli space. Do I have a map from this combinatorial moduli space to the regular moduli space? And the answer is yes. And I guess informally, how do we do this? We take the graph with these edges that have lengths on them, and I take a conformal disk whose boundary is the length of these cycles of edges, and I glue them on. And if you sort of say exactly what type of conformal structure you put on these disks, you'll end up with a surface in the end that has a specific conformal structure, that's complex structure, and also you could maybe say the center of that disk will be my marked point in the end. So we actually have a well-defined map here. It can be built. Can that be built? Yeah, that can be. So informally, I have a wire frame with a certain length to a cycle of edges, and I take a disk such that the circumference of this disk matches that length, and I glue it on. And you glue it on in a way so that it's really locally flat everywhere that you can make it. And in that way, I mean, there's another construction where you can take half-infinite strips, maybe take cylinders, put them on, cap them on with a disk. There's different constructions, but you're not going to get a conformal structure everywhere. You're going to get it almost everywhere, and then, but that's enough. You get a complex structure that comes along with that. All right. I mean, that's the conformal setting. There's also the hyperbolic setting, where there's a completely different construction, which I don't even know if I could really describe. Well, we talk about the Poincaré disk, and
the way you dealt with that last point is not the optimal way, because I mean, Riemann actually settled this point. I mean, when you make a construction, say, with vacuums and cylinders, you obviously have a metric space everywhere that's flat, except at the corners. And then Riemann showed you just take a power of z to make a coordinate. There's a unique conformal coordinate over that point, which agrees with the conformal structure outside, given by a power of z. That's actually.
And that's the argument.
The Riemann surface of algebraic Poincaré functions, he was actually using that when he was an integer. So you really get a canonical, complete Riemann surface using what Riemann does. That's not.
We have a continuous map. We want this, well, just if you count dimensions, you'll see that in general this is not going to be has no hope of being a homeomorphism, but at least it's going to be onto. And it'll actually, let me give it a name, actually ends up being a homeomorphism by the results that have been referred to previously by the work of Penner and the work of Strebel and others. And this will actually be a homeomorphism onto the moduli space cross a contractible space. And the case that I'm going to be interested in here is actually where I have a map where I only have one marked point. And in this case, MG1 comes to MG1, this is actually going to be a homeomorphism. And that's the map that I want to use in my talk.
Do you have anything to say about MG0?
Well, in the case of MG0, it's really difficult to talk about graphs, because you really need a mark point to have a boundary to glue on. And actually, I will say that later, because I'm going to talk about the hyperelliptic locus, and I really can't talk exactly about the hyperelliptic locus because I need a marked point. So what I do is choose a Weierstrass point for that, and it works out just fine. I have a homeomorphism here. So now what I want to talk about is, well, what information do I want to get out of the moduli space by looking at it in terms of fat graphs? So let me talk about the structure of the moduli space. And use this board here. There's a very important map between moduli spaces with different numbers of marked points. So I have the moduli space with n marked points and the moduli space of n plus 1 marked points. I have a map, which is really trivial. I just forget one of these marked points. So I have a map between these moduli spaces. This actually, we can extend it to the compactified moduli spaces where it's a little bit less trivial, and it really has to do with the stability conditions. Maybe a component will become unstable. We'll have to collapse that to a point. Using this map, pretty much just relying on this map, you can define characteristic classes of this bundle, which really carry all the geometric information in the cohomology ring of the moduli space. And it's referred to as the tautological ring because it's almost defined by definition. But I don't find that very enlightening. So what I'm going to just do here, well, I'm a little short on time, so let me just mention we have Psi I, which are two-dimensional cohomology classes in the moduli space. Everything I do is going to be with rational coefficients because I'm talking about the orbifold structure. I also have the kappa classes, which lie in H2A, MGN. And there's also these lambda classes, which are associated to the Hodge bundle of the moduli space. And the Hodge bundle has fiber holomorphic one forms. So the global holomorphic one forms over the curve make a dimension G vector space, and these can be patched together to get me a dimension G vector bundle over the moduli space. And I can talk about the churn characters of that. So one nice property about the kappa classes is you can define them in terms of the psi classes. So kappa A is actually defined as the push forward, if I forget the ith marked point, of psi I to the A plus 1. And now what I want to do is I want to talk about these classes or actually compute intersections of these classes. These are all cohomology classes, but remember I talked about having Poincaré duality, and we could talk about intersection theory, so I really want to take intersections of these classes, and I want to compute it on the combinatorial moduli space, a space that I can actually visualize and look at. So what I want to do is have combinatorial versions of these classes. And the tricky part is that even though I have maps from the combinatorial moduli space the ordinary moduli space, there's really no natural forgetful map here. I can't talk about forgetting a point in terms of graphs. What happens to a graph if I try to forget a marked point is really difficult to explain. In some special cases, you can say what would happen, but in general, it's very difficult. So I can't really rely on that to define my combinatorial classes. So what I'm going to do is rely on the works of others and state some results. Do I know for a fact that you can't define it?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you just...
It's a cellular map.
I mean, you can complete the diagram so the map exists. And if the boundary is really large that you're collapsing...
No, I said cellular map, not just homotopy map. I mean, the map exists.
Well, no, actually, you can have a homeomorphism. I mean, you can actually have a homeomorphism. And actually, I mean, it's a little bit trickier than that because to have the homeomorphism, actually, not just homotopy, but homeomorphism, it's the open simplex here. And what you really need is you need a projection here, too. I mean, as a standard projection, when you forget a point, as long as that coordinate's not zero, you can have a projection here. But it's natural, but it's probably not the one you want. And probably if you define this map cleverly enough, it probably can shed some light on this map as well. And really, if you have the point that you want to collapse, if it's small enough, you can get close to the map that you probably want. And actually, how much information that actually recovers is, well, actually I'm interested in that, so I guess maybe we can talk about that later. Talk about that in more detail. But what I'm saying here is that it's definitely not well known, and I can't use it to define the characteristic classes here. So, Kintsevich, he was able to come up with a representation of the psi classes in the Jerome cohomology. So, I'm going to simplify it a little bit here, and I'm just going to say on MG1 bar, he found that the psi class, where there's only one now, is represented by a two-form, and this two-form actually has nice representation in terms of graph. So if I take this two-form omega, pull it back under my map, and restrict to a simplex associated to a graph, or if you want the quotient of it by automorphism, this class can be represented in terms of the coordinates of the graph. So if I have here, I'm going to have only one boundary component. These edges will be identified in some way. And I can label them L1, L2, all the way around to LM, where of course I'm repeating some edges. And in this case, if I take the sum DLI wedge DLJ for 1 less than or equal to I less than J less than M, this will represent the class up to a factor. Here, the way I've constructed it, the length of this boundary is 2, so I have to include a factor of 1/4. And in general, if I have more than one boundary component, I have to include something about how big the boundary is in this expression. That's kind of nice. There's another class on the combinatorial moduli space. You can try to look for homology cycles, look for a locus somewhere that defines a cycle, and maybe talk about the homology class of that. And I think Witten first introduced these cycles, and let me call W1 the subset of MG. Let me just stick with MG1. Come here. Where it's equal to the union, the union of all cells associated to graphs, where the graph has a vertex of valence greater than or equal to 5, at least 5, at least has a vertex, one vertex of valence at least 5. So the maximal dimensional cells in this are graphs that are all trivalent except for one vertex that is exactly valence 5. And the trick here is that this actually defines a cycle. So I can talk about the class of it. It lies in... What's that? That's the trick. And that's... There's actually a couple ways you can show that it has a consistent orientation. The real difficulty in showing that it is a cycle is showing that it has a consistent orientation. Kincevich uses his class here. This class omega on MG1, it's actually a symplectic form. So you can talk about volumes with respect to powers of this form. And this form actually can define an orientation of volume elements. And you can talk about orientations with respect to this form. And the trick is that since all the valencies of all the vertices are odd, this can actually define a consistent orientation on all the components of this. In terms of graph cohomology, there's a similar result where you can talk about orientation, and if all the valencies of all the vertices are odd, then the cyclic order of the edges coming into each vertex gives you... Well, then on the maximal dimensional cells, they're all trivalent except for one, which is five-valent. And once you have it on the maximal dimensional cells, the rest really follows. And then, of course, Penner did another argument showing that these have an orientation, where he actually had coordinate transformations, transition functions from one cell to another, analyzed the Jacobian of this, and showed that you could consistently put an orientation on this. But yeah, that's the main point. Of course, rational coefficients. And the conjecture was that maybe this class had something to do with the kappa classes. Or more generally, I can talk about the cycle that has a vertex of valence 7, 9, things like that. And I'm seeing that my time's almost running up without me even talking about hyperelliptic graphs. So let me just mention here, kappa 1, using Poincaré duality, I can talk about this as 1/12 times the Witten cycle. Plus, I have to... There's a subtle fact that this actually can lift to the compactified moduli space. The work of Mendelo shows that you can actually lift this. So on the compactified moduli space, in the cohomology of the compactified space, I can represent the Mumford class as the Witten cycle plus the class of the boundary, where delta is the class of the boundary. Oh, well, these are cycles. This is a codimension 2 cycle. This is a 2 form. All right, so now I'm at the point where, well, this is nice because I have a cycle, so in order to find intersection products of kappa classes, maybe I can use these cycles, visualize their intersections, and actually get my hands dirty and analyze these intersections, find intersection numbers, and see if I can come up with some numbers. But the problem is that these Witten cycles, well, if I try to, say, intersect them with each other, well, that's degenerate. Or if I try to intersect them with, let's say, a 5-valent vertex Witten cycle with a 7-valent Witten cycle vertex, one will lie inside of each other. So they're highly degenerate. So I can't work with that directly unless I have some way to perturb them in some way. So now I want to talk about the hyperelliptic locus. So I'm actually going to come up with another cycle of lying in the combinatorial moduli space corresponding to the hyperelliptic locus. So recall, C as hyperelliptic implies that there's a double cover to the Riemann sphere. And there's also another way to describe this. There exists an involution with 2G plus 2 hyperelliptic, let's say, genus G. Involution with 2G plus 2 fixed points. So what I want to do is I want to look for graphs that have an involution and 2G plus 2 fixed points. And some of the graphs I've already drawn for you, for example, this one, the genus here is 1, so I want to look for 4 fixed points. And I have an involution which swaps it, and each 3 of the edges is remained fixed by that, plus I have the boundary component, so that's 4. And if I do the edge collapse of this, I get a graph that has 2 edges, which if I rotate by 180 degrees, both these edges are fixed, the boundary is fixed, and the vertex is fixed, so that satisfies it too. We know that this represents the elliptic moduli space, so of course we would expect it to satisfy this condition. So I want to generalize this to higher genus, And really the best way to do this, I guess there's more general graphs like this if I add more edges, which Penner first noticed, and he referred to them as hyperelliptic graphs. But there's actually a couple more, and I want to use this property that there's a double cover to P1. So I want to first talk about how do we represent points in the moduli space of M0n. So spheres with a certain number of marked points. And this, here's what I want to talk about. I want to say there's one boundary component that has some size. That'll represent the first marked point. The rest of the marked points are going to be marked by univalent vertices. So this will correspond to trees. And for example, let me draw a picture. So I have my first marked point here, x2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If I put a disk on, I get a sphere. So I can actually represent the moduli space of punctured spheres in terms of trees. And maximal dimensional cells here will be represented by trivalent trees. So one of the examples is what I was going to do is show the result that psi to the n minus 1 integrator of the moduli space is actually equal to 1. So if you show, if you have the integration scheme, what you can do is you can break this integral down into the different cells over the combinatorial moduli space. And then over each cell, it's going to have the same volume. And you find out that that volume, well, what you have to do is take the volume of that cell times the number of cells you have. So you find out that the volume of that cell exactly cancels the number of cells you have. And so how do you actually find out how many cells you have? You have to count trees. So let's say here CK is equal to the number of trees with K internal vertices. I'm moving really fast because I got 5 minutes. So slow me down if you really want to know something. So with K internal vertices, these are rooted trees. This will be Catalan's number, which is equal to 1 over K plus 1. 2k over k, and the derivation of that is kind of fun. So when I want to talk about hyperelliptic graphs, I want to say, well, it's a double cover of the sphere, so maybe I should look at pairs of trees. So if I take a tree, and I make a pair of that, a mere symmetric pair, and I assign length to this tree that match the length of this tree, I can fatten it, and then I can glue them together with a twist, just as I did in the other case. Here. And what I get is I get a graph of genus. In this case, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So genus is equal to 2, and I have 2g plus 1 leaves. So I have trees with 2g plus 1 leaves. So the maximal dimensional cells of the hyperelliptic locus correspond to trivalent trees with 2g plus 1 leaves. And if I just look, the lengths of these are completely determined by the length of these because I want to maintain the symmetry. And if I just look at the space of trees, that's just sort of like the sociohedron. And we know it's a contractible space. So if I want to understand the topology of the hyperelliptic locus, it's really this contractible space. But it's all about the gluing. How do I glue the boundary of this contractible space together? So really, how does this gluing come in? It comes in when one of these edges collapses. And then I can expand it in a different way. And that really describes the topology of the hyperelliptic locus. So the next result that I was going to do...
It's covered by two cells?
No, there's many cells for each tree. You're going to get a cell. And there's certain isomorphism because I have a symmetry that rotates this 2g plus 1, rotates the leaves. So the next integral I was going to do is actually integrate over this space psi to the 2g minus 1. And once again, you have an integration scheme where you just integrate over all the cells, maximal dimensional cells of the combinatorial moduli space. So this will be equal to a sum. And now here, we have automorphisms, unlike the sphere case. So I really have to factor by the automorphism group. And let me just explain this now, what the integration scheme is, because I do have... I lied before. I still have 5 minutes. My cell maps into the moduli space say MG1. By this map, I can really think of this as factoring through the Teichmuller space. So I really want to think of this as the cell mapping into the Teichmuller space and then mapping down into the moduli space where I quotient out here. And the nice thing is that on the interior of these cells, this is actually a nice differentiable map. It's more than just a homeomorphism. So I can actually pull back differential forms here. And I can actually integrate forms on this space by pulling them back one cell at a time, adding them up. But I really have to divide by the quotient because I'm not really integrating over the whole cell. So I have to divide by the automorphism group. So I want to add up over all trees. Here they're going to be trivalent. Have to divide by the automorphism group of the cell that I get from this tree, which is not really the full cell associated to the graph because I have the symmetry constraint. So it's actually sort of a slice down the middle of the cell. Right, I have constraints on what the lengths are. Automorphism times the integral over the cell of this form to the 2g minus 1. This ends up having a volume equal to, sort of like the last case, 2g minus 1 factorial over 4g minus 2 factorial. But now there's a couple things that happen. I have twice as many trees. Each of the edges is rescaled, so there's actually a factor of 2 that shows up. So I have 2 to the 2g minus 1. But now it's just reduced to a counting argument. It's not strictly a counting argument, it's an orbifold counting argument. But actually, orbifold counting arguments are easier than regular counting arguments. So how do I actually say what this is? This is just going to be the same, the number of trees. So I'm going to have the number of trees. How many internal vertices does it have? Well, I have 2g plus 1 leaves, so that's going to be 2g minus 1 internal vertices. And then I have to divide by, of course, the factor of 2, which switches them. And then I have to divide by 2g plus 1, because this is really rooted trees, and I want to get rid of the root. And if you put this all together, you find that it's actually equal to 1 over 2 to the 2g times 2g plus 1 factorial. That's a nice result. That showed up in Faber and Panharapandey's paper, Gromov-Witten theory and Hodge integrals. And really, the goal of all this is to get Hodge integrals. So let me go to I got 2 minutes. The example that I really care about, there's an intersection of combinatorial cycles. I want to do this integral. Integral over the hyperelliptic locus of the kappa class psi to the 2g minus 2. I have Poincaré duality, I have intersection of cycles. This I can represent as a Witten cycle plus the boundary. So I can write this as 1 over 12 times. Here I have an integral over the hyperelliptic locus intersect the Witten cycle plus something over the boundary of the hyperelliptic locus. Really, I want to talk about its closure, so this is just the intersection with the boundary of the moduli space, psi pg minus 2. This is just this. I can use induction it's just a pinched hyperelliptic curve. If I unpinch it, I get a hyperelliptic curve of less genus. So really, what I want to look at is this, and I want to understand this intersection. Once again, the volume of every cell is going to be the same, so it's just a counting argument. And I just want to count how many cells are there. Not only how many cells are there, what are the automorphisms of it, so it's orbifold counting. Not only that, I got to know the intersection number. And the intersection number is really the most important part, or at least the funnest part, or the last part I figured out, or I don't know. It's one of those. So there's 2 cases. So what I need is I need a pair of trees plus a 5-valent vertex. There's one easy way to get this. The easy way to get this is to start with a tree with a 5-valent vertex and then make a pair of it and then glue them together. And then I get, just with my construction of a pair of trees, I get the result. I can count trees of this type. Actually, counting trees ends up being, well, I don't know if it's easy, but it seems like you can count any type of tree that you want. The more that I learn, I'm not really that great at it, but I can at least count these types of trees. The second case that's interesting is actually, it happens when a vertex or an edge here collapses. And this is, I think, more interesting. So what happens is you actually get a vertex of valence 6. Anytime I collapse an edge in between here, I'm always going to get an even valent vertex. So I have to think about even valent vertices. So then here it's going to be completed to some type of tree. And if I cut this in half, really what I'm doing is I'm taking two trivalent trees and gluing them together at one of the vertices. So I count the number of trivalent trees, have to get rid of the root, count the number of vertices to glue together. There's a factor of 3 how I glue it together, but then there's a factor of 3 of how I can cut them apart. Those all cancel, but I still need the intersection number. So I can count all that. The volume of them are going to be the same. So the last piece of the puzzle is what are the intersection numbers of these two graphs? And then my calculation can go through. This one's kind of weird because as soon as I get a 5-valent vertex here, I get a 5-valent vertex there. So I got two of them. The question is, do they add or do they cancel? And it's the question of orientation again. How do I define an orientation on this cycle? I can define an orientation on the Witten cycle. I can define an orientation on the hyperelliptic locus. How do I do it together? Ding, 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 ding. That was tough for me. So what I do is I refer to the way that you actually construct the Witten cycle. And the way you construct the Witten cycle is by integrating along the fiber of the psi class. So really what you do is you forget a boundary. So what I'm going to do is run the tape in reverse and remember a boundary. So I put a small boundary there. And then I forget it, and I get the Witten cycle. So what happens when I create this boundary, well, it doesn't matter which one I do because there's a symmetry. So there's really only one graph that I'm looking at. But what happens when I add the boundary, all of a sudden my symmetry disappears. So normally I have to do 1 over automorphism, so I always have to include a factor of 1/2, but then I have two intersections. Or, as soon as I add the boundary, well, I only have one graph and one symmetry. So you find out that the intersection number, well, in the case I was thinking about, really should be 2. They shouldn't cancel each other. If you believe that, that's cool. This case is more interesting. This is actually analyzed by looking at the associahedron, A6. Now, the associahedron A6, if I was really good, I have... Well, if you count dimensions, you'll find out that they're traversed. So they're really... They are non-degenerate, but non-generic. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I only lost two edges. I lost two edges here, but I didn't lose any independent edges here because these were determined by those.
Which two cycles are you interested?
The Witten cycle, which has
a... So it's a drawing.
This is a drawing of the intersection.
That's the hyperelliptic cycle there, right?
I can't really draw the cycle here. Here I can maybe draw the cycle. But this is a drawing of the intersection. If I want to think about what it actually looks like, maybe I'll perturb this one while keeping this one the same, and that would be the Witten cycle. Or maybe I could perturb them both symmetrically, and that would be the hyperelliptic locus. And watching how they intersect gives me this. And really, part of my motivation for doing this whole problem is to really get to the bottom of this idea of how do these orbifold cycles intersect? How do I actually visualize it? What are the intersection numbers? What does this all mean? Well, this one here, let me just say that I drew 3 graphs, and there was 9 one cells. And some of them corresponded to graphs like that. Oh, let me see. Oh, no, that was different. 3 of them are symmetric. 6 of them are not symmetric in some sense. So what I have is I sort of have 6 spokes sticking out, and then I have 3 spokes along a plane. And what the hyperelliptic locus does, it's really a symmetry constraint, saying that this side is equal to that side. So I have a plane cutting it through the middle. And so I have a plane cutting through the 3 that lie along that plane really don't count. And then I have 3 coming in this side, 3 coming in this side. And you can argue that that should be an intersection number of 3. And you can do more argument. We'll say, well, how does the actual Witten cycle, how is it created, do things like that. I mean, I'm not happy with this answer. I think there should be a better explanation for it, but I'm at least convinced. So if I put this all together, let me just give the result now. that in my calculation that I got. And the integral along the hyperelliptic locus of kappa 1 psi to the 2g minus 2, it's a little bit like the other one. I still have a factor of 2 to the 2g. Maybe I should look at this. I got the punchline. Make sure I get it right. I still have 2 to the g, 2g plus 1 factorial, but now I have a polynomial on top, and this polynomial actually has a nice form of 2g minus 1 squared over 2 to the 2g, 2g plus 1 factorial, which is a little bit like the other case. And let me draw two other cases here just to get your juices or get your curiosity going. The kappa 0 class is just the Euler characteristic of the fiber, integrate along the fiber. So this is just going to be 2g minus 1. Over 2 to the 2g, 2g plus 1 factorial, and the case I did before, psi to the 2g minus 1 is just 1 over 2 to the 2g, 2g plus 1 factorial. So it kind of fits nicely into this pattern. And generalizing it to the next one, to kappa 2, is really, it's really tricky because no longer are they transverse to each other. No, they're degenerate. You get some really bad intersections along those cycles. And that's only 6 minutes over. So, thank you.